balcony. Didn't see you up there. My name is Jan Fall, and I've taught parenting to parents for a long, long time, probably 4 or 5 years. So, and I've done a variety of things. Now I'm a freelance writer and speaker in the field of parenting, and this is my new book. It will be out August 3rd. It's called Amazing Minds, The Science of Nurturing Your Child's Developing Mind with Games, Activities, and More. And so I'm going to be talking about the book, the information in this book. Obviously, we're a small group, so I hope you'll ask questions. And before we get into the questions, I'm going to give about 20 minutes of information and then field questions. And we have a subject here that we can even demonstrate some of the activities on. So we're happy that he's here. Hi, come on in. Are you going to the Hobbit? Or are you going to Infants and Toddlers? Or are you just getting something from here? So if you're going to the Hobbit, you can come through here. There's no other way.
Yep, come on through.
Yeah, oh please. Yeah.
Well, this is Spades and Toddlers.
We're okay. We're good.
Oh, we need to bring the Hobbit.
We need the Hobbit.
We're so far past being this
morning. It's still very interesting information, even if you don't live with an infant or work with a toddler. Just to understand a little bit about babies, that they are born, of course, very fragile and dependent on caregivers. But despite the fact that they are very fragile and depend on us, they have a very active mind. And there's a lot of erroneous information out there in the world today about what to do to enhance the intellectual development of a child. And you've probably heard about baby Mozart and baby Einstein, and there's huge lawsuits going on.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, around that, because they're making claims about things that really aren't, that they have no founding for. So I'm here to save the day and let parents know what children are seeking to know. And so what I'm doing today is not about what you can do to enhance the intellectual ability of a child. What I'm here to do today, and what's in my book, is to tell you what researchers have determined infants and toddlers' learning agenda, what they arrive on this earth seeking to know. There's a very specific developmental timeline that I think you'll recognize if you live and work with young children. So the better we know what children are seeking to know, the better our relationship will be with a child. Because if you understand that a child is learning about the fact that things still exist even if they're out of sight, then if you know that that's part of their learning agenda, then you won't feel silly playing peekaboo, because that really helps them understand that things continue to exist when they're out of sight. And so those are the kinds of things that I'm going to go through. So what I'm going to do is take you through the basic agenda and the other. So there's two things that I'm doing today. I want you to come away with a new respect for the mind of an infant and a toddler. And then also, I really like to talk about the research. How do we know this? What did the researchers do? So I hope you also have a new respect for the people who have spent time in scientific labs with children this age and the age of that little person around, the other little person around here, because the research is pretty fascinating. And I'm from the Seattle area, and there's an Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences at the University of Washington, and so right in our own backyard, right here in Washington State, a lot of this research has been done. So the first piece of research, and I get really excited about this information, and so I hope to excite you, because it's pretty fascinating, but forgive me if I get overly excited about it, because I think it continues to fascinate me. So the first thing that's important to know is that children arrive on this earth with their senses at work. So they hear even in the womb, they can touch, they can smell, they can taste, and they can see. Their seeing is not as well developed as the other senses, but within a very short period of time, by 12 months, some researchers say 6 months, some by 12 months, 12 months. By 6 to 12 months, they have 20/20 vision. But one of the questions that parents ask, I mean, when you look at a little baby, is, does my baby see me? And I remember when my daughter was born, I was looking at her, and I said to my mother, I think she sees me. And my mother said, oh, for heaven's sakes, no, she doesn't. And so, she you're just a blur to her, whatever. But what researchers have done is they ask that question, can babies see? And so what the researchers did was they hooked up a pacifier to an electronic video screen. And so they exploited the fact that babies like to suck. And so, the babies would suck on a pacifier, and they put up a checkerboard, because babies like black and white things to look at. And then they put up a picture of a face. And babies would suck harder and longer to keep the face in view, because they want to connect with a human face. Why? Why are they drawn to look at a human face? Because if there's a human face in front of them, and watch what I'm doing. What's the distance here?
A foot.
About a foot. And why a foot? Why can babies see better at a foot? Because that's the distance between the nursing mother's face and the baby's face. So that's the distance from which infants see the best. And so, so what they discovered was babies would suck harder and longer to keep a face in view. Well, so then the researchers wanted to know, when do they know the mother, and I speak of the mother in kind of a generic sense. It could be whoever is the primary caregiver. I guess, forgive me for being old-fashioned, but that's typically the mother. Sometimes it's a father, sometimes it's a grandparent, sometimes it's a nanny or another caregiver, but we're going to call that person mother, okay? So anyway, so they would, then they would put up the picture of a strange person, somebody the baby had never known before, and the baby would be interested and suck for a while, but then babies, like all of us, get bored and they'd stop sucking. And then they'd slip up on the video screen a picture of the mother, and the babies would suck harder, even harder, and even longer when the mother's face was there. So, and this is at a very young age. I'm not going to tell you how old they are yet. And then they tried another experiment, because of course, if my face were up and an Asian person's picture were up, we look very, very different, right? So of course the baby's going to suck at any blonde-haired, white-skinned person thinking that's the mother. So what the researchers did, they put up people with similar complexion, similar hair color, similar eye color, and children would suck longer. They recognized their mother's face, their particular mother's face, between people of similar face, eye, and hair color, because they knew her. And why? Because they know they're programmed to connect with their mother, because they know that that person is going to do the most to keep them alive. And that's what they're about, is survival. And so the age of the children who are able to recognize their mother from other people is less than 1 week old. So that's, just, again, pretty fascinating what these little babies can do. Okay, another thing that's important to know about babies is that they're highly programmed to focus in on language. And I don't have time to give all the research about this, but they would have children listen to language and also other emulated speech patterns. And children, again, would prefer to listen to language, the language in their own home. They would suck longer to keep on the pacifier hooked up to an electronic audio device to keep they recognized the sounds of language and wanted to hear that. But even more than language, as the musician came in the room, children are even more interested in hearing music. And it's not just, it's not just piano music, but it's singing. That melodic kind of sing-songy rhyme, rhythm and repetition that are in many children's songs, that they are very, very interested in that. And you can see it. If you go to church and there's babies in church, the minute the music starts playing, they start paying attention to the music. I've done my own little church research, and kids will be fidgeting during the sermon or whatever, but the minute music starts, they pay attention. So language is the second thing that that children are focused in on as part of their learning agenda. And I was going to say something else about that, so they'll come back to me. Okay, the third thing is that children are highly interested, well, right at about 1 month old, they are combining their senses. Remember I said that children are born with all their senses at work. Now, as you're sitting here, you're listening to me, you're seeing me, whether you realize it or not, you're probably smelling me. I mean, if I smelled like a cow, that would be weird, but I smell like a middle-aged woman, and so that's, you know, in sync with your senses. My movement goes with what I'm saying. So everything's pretty much in sync. All your senses work together. If you touched me, that would be in sync with who I am and what I do. Please, you know, taste. Anyway, we won't go all day. But anyway, so children are working to combine their senses because they get more information that way. If they can see something and feel something and taste something. I bring this up because if you think about the world of a baby, and they're in a home that the TV's on and the dog's barking and spaghetti sauce is cooking on the stove and, you know, mother's on the phone and the television's blaring, well, that's a lot of sensory experience to sort out, right? And a lot of times babies will turn fussy about that because it's hard on us, right, even. But think of a baby who's just trying to combine the use of their senses. So mothers know just naturally that when that fussiness starts, when there's too much going on, to take their baby away and rock the baby and soothe the baby so that they're in a quiet spot and then the baby will calm down. So they're combining use of their senses. Okay, that's the third learning part of the learning agenda. The fourth is that children are born to imitate. That children will imitate certain facial expressions at under 72 hours old. And the main one that they do is tongue thrusting. That do your own experiment. If you have a grandchild or a new baby, that if you stick your tongue out at a baby, you got to give them a little time. Your face has to be about 10 inches from their face. They will put their tongue outside of their mouth. And it's pretty amazing when you think about it. The baby has never seen themselves in a mirror, right? They don't know where they are, but they perceive that they are like you, and so that they can do what you do. And this is a really important piece of information because imitation is really the most efficient way children learn, and certainly any of us. And the thing about children, of course, is that they don't discriminate between good behavior and bad behavior. And so if you do some kind of obnoxious behavior, the likelihood is great that your children will copy that. If you do a lot of wonderful and kind and things in the world, they will copy those things. So we have to be on guard because kids are watching us. They're looking at us. They're learning from us. And so my story about that was when my daughter was about 2 and a half, we went on an Easter egg hunt. And, you know, grandma was there and grandpa and cousins and aunts and uncles. It was a beautiful day in Seattle and she had a cute little Easter dress on and a little basket. And she gets out of the van and she says, "Oh, shit, I forgot my sunglasses." yeah, true story. And so I said, I better, where did she learn that? Anyway, you have to be careful around children. Okay, the fifth learning is that children are learning about how the physical world works. That, you know, you come into a room here, and you all know that these chairs are going to stay right here, and people are going to, you know, people wander in and out, and, you know, that's okay with all of us. But if something kind of weird happened, I mean, if somebody walked in the door and started bouncing, you know, going like this, you know, we'd all think, well, that's kind of weird. Why are they doing that? Or if somebody walked in and just banged and went right into a wall, we would think that's kind of weird, right? Well, babies, you know, although they seem to just be sitting there, you know, staring into nothingness, they are very, very good observers. And so they're learning about how the physical world works. And here's some of the things that they're learning about. One is that if you ever are around a baby and you don't know what to do, just get out a ball. I didn't have a smaller ball, but this is eternal entertainment for an infant and a toddler from about 5 months on, because this ball will do so many interesting things. And here's just a little bit of the research, that they're learning that big things will go down a ramp, a big ball will go down into a ramp and hit, kind of like a billiard ball, will hit another ball and it will scoot ahead, right? And that's one of the things that kids are learning about, because objects displace one another. A car would bump into a bicycle that would fall over. And so they're learning all of those kinds of things as they watch what goes on in the environment. So what researchers did, they had, actually it was a small ball, and it would go down the ramp, and it would hit a bigger ball, and, it would hit a toy, a big toy, and by a false device, the toy would move ahead. At 5.5 months, see, now we know that wouldn't happen, right? A little ball couldn't move a big toy ahead, right? Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But babies at 5.5 months didn't know that. They hadn't figured it out yet. And so by the false device in the scientific experiment, the big toy moved ahead, and babies were interested, but it was like okay with them. At 6.5 months, they did exactly the same experiment, took the ball, rolled it down the ramp, hit a small ball, hit a big toy, and it moved ahead. And babies are perplexed. It's like, whoa, that's not supposed to be that way. And so by looking at their face, we know that they've come to understand that the object moving the toy ahead would have to be bigger than the toy. And so those kinds of activities are just of high interest to children. They're learning that the difference between animate and inanimate objects, that people move themselves, right? And that people move chairs by their observation. They're also learning that they're actually learn to count at 5 months up to three. It's not that they go one, two, three, but if I have three children are watching, so there's three objects here, and if somehow I was able to sneak this away so the baby couldn't see it, they'd think, where did that one object go? Because they can keep track of three objects. This is for another experiment. Anyway, another thing that children like to do is to make things happen. If you live with a toddler, you know this. It's like, why are they so interested in remote controls? It's the most fascinating thing in the room, right? Walk over, push a button, the television goes off, push another button, it goes on, it goes off, it goes louder, it goes slow. They want to make things happen. It starts at about 3 months of age. That showed what they did in this research experiment was they exploited the fact that babies like to kick their legs, right? And so they counted how many times the babies would just lie on their back and kick their legs. And then they tied a ribbon to the baby's ankle. And what the babies found out very quickly was, you know, at first they just moved their little legs, but soon they figured out that if they moved their legs very quickly, the mobile overhead would start to dance around, okay? I can make things happen in my environment. And they were very excited about this fact. Okay, so then the researchers took them home, or the mothers took the babies home, came back to the research lab the next day, and this is 3 months old now. Think of a three-month-old. That's a little tiny baby, right? They put the baby down, tied the ribbon to his ankle, tied the ribbon to the mobile. The baby didn't slowly warm up to kicking, to having the mobile move again. It started in really fast. So they realized, they remembered that by kicking fast, they could get that mobile to go. And so not only at 3 months are they remembering, but they're understanding cause and effect. When I do this, this happens. Now the other part about this, which I'll get into in a little while, is that they're fascinated what makes us do things too. So if I put my dolly to bed, my mommy and daddy smile and they like that. But if I touch the remote control, my daddy gets really mad. Is that gonna happen all the time or just some of the time? I gotta try. they learning about how physical things work, but how people work too. And along with this, kids are little scientists figuring out how the world works. And so I have, you know, three kids, they're all grown adults, but I have stories about them. So when my son was, I don't know, somewhere between 18 months and 2 and a half, I don't remember, he was testing a hypothesis. His hypothesis was that if you deadbolt the lock, the people on the outside of the door can't get in the house. Well, unfortunately, it happened on a rainy Seattle morning when I was in my bathrobe outside emptying the garbage can. So I go outside to empty the garbage can quickly, and I turn to get back in the house, and he had deadbolted the lock to just see if it was really true that what he thought about was actually a fact. And indeed it was. So not to panic. At this point, I had been teaching parent education for 20 years. I had some skills under my belt. So I stood outside the window and I went, "Hi, Alan." And he just walked over and unlocked the door and let me in. He had tested his hypothesis. So kids are trying out all kinds of things. My point about this is that a lot of things that children do look naughty. But really, what they're about is their learning agenda. And what I want parents to know, I don't see, there's a few young parents, is that their learning agenda, that the things that they are seeking to know, often overrides the parent's interest, or the child's interest in pleasing you. They're driven, they are driven to figure out their world, even if it jeopardizes temporarily a relationship with you. So that's why it really helps if we understand the basis of why they're doing things. It's not because they're mean or, you know, uncaring or unloving or unresponsive or uncompliant. It's just they kind of figure out their environment because they're figuring out, they're learning about survival. Okay, another one is just to understand number 6 on the learning agenda is that children are learning about emotions. And children are born expressing 7 emotions. They are joy, interest, sadness, distress, disgust, surprise, and fear. At 5 months, they can read emotions. They can read your emotions. And here's how the researchers did it. That they would have a child look at the mother's face. I can't remember if it was actually the mother or a video. It doesn't matter. But anyway, the mother, you know, the person would be smiling. And then, of course, babies, like all of us, turn bored. And so then the babies would look away. And so then the mother would look so sad. And the babies would notice the difference. They would sit up and pay attention. Another time the mother would be mad. And then again, you know, they get bored of the sad, and then they'd show a mad face, and the children would pay attention again. So at 5 months, they're reading the emotional expression. And when I talk to parents, I tell them, so what you want to do when you communicate with young children, you want to make sure that your voice, your body language, and your emotional expression are in sync. Because if a child's taking a screwdriver to an outlet and you say, "Sweetheart, don't do that," that's a very confusing message for a child, right? You want to go, you know, "No, that's not okay," because they can read fear on your face, and that communicates something to the child. I mean, they'll probably stop temporarily. And I said temporarily. You've really got to take that screwdriver away. Because, you know, any self-respecting toddler is going to continue to go and, you know, find out what that outlet is about. But, so that's why we need to take it away. But anyway, another thing that happens with young children, and if you've been around kids at about 12 months, you know that this is true. And again, this is your importance in the life of children. That, let's say there's a big, beautiful toy right here, a very interesting object that's actually a toy that a child has never seen, okay? So at 12 months, a child will walk up to it, and then they'll look to grandma as if this is a good idea or a bad idea. It's called social referencing, okay? Again, they're programmed to survive, right? They don't know about this toy, and so they're going to get information from grandma or mom or dad or whoever it is, primary caregiver, to see if this is a good idea or not. If it's okay, you're going to go, child's going to go in. If you go, the child's going to back away, okay? But if it's an 18-month-old, they're going to back away temporarily and then go for it anyway, because they've got another agenda going on. But so you're a social reference for your children, and I want to emphasize this, because later in the week I'm going to talk about instilling virtues, values, and morals in children, and you continue all the years. I mean, I have kids in their 30s, and I was 10 when I had them. But anyway, I am still a social reference for them. They have other references, peers, media, that they go to, but parents continue, no matter what age, to be a social reference for the children. We need to remember this because it's a power we have and it's an important one. Okay, so another thing that happens, the seventh point of the child's learning agenda, is that they are beginning to read your mind. Now that sounds kind of interesting, doesn't it? Who can read other people's minds? Well, we all do. I'm trying to read your mind as I'm talking here, because I'm trying to figure out if I'm actually communicating with you or not, how you're feeling about this. When you have a conversation with anyone, there's a give and take involved. Does he get it? Am I explaining it? What's her background? Well, children start to do this at about 10 to 11 months. Read your mind. And one of the things that they do is follow your gaze. So if you're, a mom in your home, and all of a sudden you look out the window, you've got your baby here, your 10, 11 month old in your arms, on your hip, and you see that the neighbors have a new car, so you're peering out the window, your 10 to 11 month old child will look too. You don't have to say anything, you can say something, but they're following your eyes, and they're interested in what you're looking at. They recognize that your eyes are the window into your brain. And again, it's about survival. They know their learning is going to be efficient if they learn from you. And so there's also research that says that if you put words to that, oh, there's a car, the neighbor's got a new red Chevrolet or whatever, that even enhances children's language development. So they begin to follow your gaze. Let's see what else happens in that. Oh, another thing that is interesting is that children begin, and I have to get my ages right here, at 18 months, not till 18 months, but they understand your intentions. So let's say you have a piece of paper and you're tossing it into the garbage can and you miss and you just leave it there and think, oh, I'll get it later. And then later the child's copying you. They're not going to copy you missing the garbage can. They're going to copy you and they want to get it in the garbage can. They understand your intentions. They've read your mind to the point that they can figure out what you were meaning to do, even if you didn't do it. Another part of reading your mind is the fact, and this is probably one of the most important developmental milestones with young children. I have a granddaughter, she's almost one, and she just learned to walk, and we're very excited about this. But I'm more excited about the fact that when I was with her last week, she looked at my dog and said, "What's that?" And she pointed. Okay, notice when, are you guys coming through? It's okay. Notice when young children learn to point. It's at about 12 months. And what this means, now a baby, a child under 12 months, they will either play with a toy or interact with you. Okay, they don't do both. If you're reading a story to a child under one, they're just looking at the book, or they're looking at your face, but they can't focus on both, all right? Once they get to be 12 months, they can focus on you and something else. And this is a really important developmental milestone because it says, I don't know what that is, and I can learn about it all on my own, but if I say to Grandpa, what's that? I'm going to learn about that quicker. It's called the cognitive triangle. And really, that's what learning is all about. You are all here, we're participating in the cognitive triangle. There's me, this research, and you. And so you're learning from me about this research. And the thing that's important about it children, well, there's many things that are important about it, but it's important to know that children who are autistic do not point because they're not social. And so they don't, they don't have that skill to pull somebody else into what they're seeking to know. And so here's just an example. Let's say you're in the grocery store with your 12-month-old baby. And, oh, let's say your child's older. Let's say they're three. And your child sees a woman who's pregnant. And your child says, "Why is that lady's belly so big?" And you say, "Oh, don't talk about that. Don't talk about it. We don't talk about it." And so, well, you get a message really clearly that this is something we're not going to talk about in our family, a woman who's pregnant. But, well, let me tell you that that is not going to stop your child's curiosity. Children are highly curious. They're going to get that information satisfied from somewhere. Mother's not comfortable talking about it. So who else am I going to ask? Well, I could ask Dad or the neighbor, or I could learn about from television or the internet. And so what I'm telling you is that when your children point at something, explain it to them. And because you want your intake on the subject, right? And then also, you will get, as children get older, they don't point, right? Because we say that's impolite. So they'll look at something and they'll wonder about it. And if you can see that they're curious about it, you probably want to give them some information, particularly if it's, you know, something that's important to you. And because, again, if they don't get it from you, they're going to get it from somebody else, and you at least want them to hear your take on it. So that pointing is a very, very interesting developmental milestone. Okay, so a couple other things that children learn to do. At 3 and 4 months, they start to categorize objects, which is an incredible skill. They do it visually at first, and then later at about 18 months, they do it manually. Think about the world if we couldn't categorize. Think how difficult learning would be if we couldn't put chairs and bicycles and men and women and dishes and colors and all those things into different categories. The other thing that, of course, happens is children will over-categorize, so we have to be careful about that. One day my son said to me, "All dads work and all moms stay at home." He was about four. You know, I've worked my whole life, and at least part-time, and certainly I worked outside the home, and I don't know what he thought I was doing inside the home that wasn't called work. And then, of course, his dad worked out of the home, and he worked in the home. But see how much easier life would be if we could just say, all dads work and all moms stay at home. But when children over-categorize, and we have to challenge that. But it's a very, you can play categorization games with little children because they're seeking to put objects into categories. Okay, another thing that children do is that they learn to use tools. Starting at about 9 to 10 months. Did you know that crows use tools? And I think some monkeys use tools, but mostly it's a human condition. So if, where's my ball? Well, hey, let's just
chair behind you.
I'll just use this. So let's say this is an interesting toy. A child probably wouldn't do that. But if a child were sitting here, and this interesting toy is sitting there, most 8 to 10 month old children, or like an 8 month old, if they're crawling, would just crawl and get the cup. Okay. But once they get to be 10 to 11 months, it's like a little light bulb goes on over their head. And even if they had never seen an object on a blanket before, all on their own, they'll figure out, oh, I can use this blanket as a tool to get the cup. And so, and it's a huge developmental milestone. I mean, think about all the tools in the world that we have. And so, again, you know, you want to engage with your child. Have some, watch them, see the tools that they're using, and you can play along with that. You can have, like, you can have an umbrella, and you can have a ball that's gone under the sofa, and say, "I don't know how to get the ball. How are we going to get the ball?" And see if a light bulb goes off, and the child takes the crook of the umbrella to get the ball from under the sofa. So those kinds of things children are learning between 9 and 10 months. Okay, another thing, as I said earlier, but I want to reemphasize, that children are learning that objects still exist when they're out of sight. And that's why children love peekaboo and later hide and seek. And those games go on and on and on. There's one child on record who played Jack in the Box over and over and over again in the same setting 17 times in a row and was equally surprised every single time. And so when there's, you know, if you're in a restaurant with a child and you have a cup and some, I didn't have very good objects, I didn't bring props and Narnie was close, but you can do this, you're in a restaurant waiting for your food, you can play this game over and over and over again and many, many different versions. But the thing about children is if you never play peekaboo or hide and seek with a child, they will play this game all on their own. I witnessed a little girl and she, there was a table runner on the coffee table and she would take, let's see if I have something that's better. It was something flat like this, I can't remember what it was, but she would take it and she would slip it under there and then she'd kind of waltz around like this and then she'd come back and then she would do it again. She would just come back and then she would do it again. And her mother said, her grandmother reported that she did this for about a week. This was, and then finally she got it, that this object still existed even though it was under the blanket. But what about this object someplace else, under a coat? Will it still exist there? So then they have to try that out, right? So all those different things, there's many, many scenarios on that. And so it's, you know, have fun with children doing that.
So at what age do they make that connection generally?
It's, let's see what it says. 9 months, about 9 months. But they still love it. Even beyond, I mean, maybe, I think they're beginning to do it at 9 months. They begin playing peekaboo at 9 months. It goes on. They love hide and seek, and see, hide and seek things move, but you still know they exist, so you got to figure out where it's moved to. But you can play that for a long, long time with children. Okay, here's another thing that happens with kids. This is another, I mean, so much of this is important, but okay, here's a piece of research. Researcher on this side of the table, 14-month-old on this side of the table, on the table were two bowls. One that had yummy fish crackers and one that had raw broccoli. Okay, so the researcher says to the 14-month-old, have some. And every 14-month-old in the research study ate the
goldfish.
Okay, and so then the researcher ate the yummy raw broccoli. Good broccoli, great broccoli. Okay, so then the researcher said to the baby, give me some. And the 14-month-old children gave the researcher the goldfish. Because what the baby is thinking at 4 months old is, I don't know what that broccoli business is about, but since I like fish crackers, you must too, and so I'll give you what I like. Okay? Then they did exactly the same study now with 18-month-olds. All the 18-month-olds ate the fish crackers. The researcher ate the broccoli. The researcher says to the baby, give me some. And now, at 18 months, the child picks up the broccoli and gives it to the researcher. This is a huge developmental milestone because it says you and I can have different opinions about what we like and what we don't like. The child is the beginning of empathy, that the child steps into the body or the mind and emotions of someone else and says, even though I don't like it, this is what you're thinking and feeling, and so I'll give you what you like. Think about the world if we couldn't do that. We would just, if I needed a pencil and I didn't imagine what you were thinking, I'd just walk over and take your pencil away, right? But I know that she's writing with that and that she's using that and that belongs to her and she's busy with that. So I can imagine that that wouldn't be something that would, you know, build relationship between us. And so babies begin to understand that everybody has different desires and interests, and it all starts at about 18 months old.
And that starts, I mean, that somehow comes between 14, it's not present at 14.
It's not present at 14.
It is present at 18.
It is, but oh, thanks for bringing that up, because we have to be really careful about this. It's not in place. Okay, it begins at 18 months, and it's really not in place until about 8 years. And so, but through many, many experiences, and parents will say, you know, it's like, if I'm a toddler and I take your pen, and the mother says, I just grab your pen, and I'm a toddler, and I'm really happy that I have it. And the mother says, well, how would you like it, to her toddler, if somebody took that pen from you? The toddler, you know, if the toddler could talk, he'd say, well, I really don't care, because I'm just really happy that I have it right now. And so we have to, and there's some children who get it more easily than other children, at about age 8, then they can begin to do that. But it's through our interactions with children and through their experience that, you know, they pick up on that.
Mm-hmm. So is that tied in with the idea of, like, my actions have an effect on you?
Absolutely. That's what empathy is all about. I mean, that's a very moral issue, right? That how I behave affects others. And so it's a moral emotion. Empathy is a moral emotion. And so it affects all of us. I mean, in you know, what we do and what we say and what we write, and so we have to be able to have that skill of stepping into the mind and emotions of another person to say, how is my behavior affecting that person? And so it begins at about 18 months. And yeah. Okay, so a few other things that happen that are pretty important. One, I think I'll go briefly on this, but children learn to use pronouns. Pronouns are really hard for kids to learn, but they do begin at about 18 months to do that. They also recognize themselves in the mirror at about 18 months. But also, at about 18 months, they have this strong interest in what it's called self-definition. They recognize that they are separate people from you. And one of the ways that they do it is to claim that things are mine. Okay? And I mean, most of my professional life, I've worked with parents of toddlers. And that's probably the most disturbing thing that for parents. Because, even more than hitting sometimes. Because we think, oh, this child is going to be, you know, grabbing and hoarding and, you know, taking things from other people. They're just claiming things are mine. Well, in a research situation, they noticed when children use pronouns and when they recognize themselves in the mirror. And right along with that came that interest in claiming toys are mine, okay? So they paired up children who had a strong self-definition. They had their pronouns down, they recognized themselves in the mirror, and they were claiming things as mine. So they paired these two children, right, who were going through this period of self-definition. And what they realized was that once these kids figured out, well, these are my cars and those are your cars and these are my dolls and your dolls, that once they established that, then they played very well together. And think about that. Think about that as adults. I mean, we all know we go into somebody's house, we're guests, those are all their things, and we're very courteous about that. Well, it starts at about 18 months, that need to establish who you are strongly. And once you have established that, then you can negotiate. Then you can solve problems together. Then you can play well together and all of that. So it's a need. I mean, it's disturbing to see it. And what I tell parents is that what you do is to tell them the truth of the situation. Yes, that is your doll. No, that's your sister's book, but you can look at it right now. Yes, that's your friend is holding your doll. She's not going to take it home. She's just going to play with it for a little while. So tell them the truth about that. But it's a period of development that children must go through. So that's self-definition. Okay, so those are the main... Oh, one other thing I have to tell you. Okay, in another play situation, they paired mothers with their children in a play situation. And the mothers, who were very supportive, well, they paired them with children in a play situation. For about 20 minutes, they played. And then the mothers were to say, now help me clean up, okay? And so the children who were compliant, the children who were helpful, mostly had mothers who were supportive of them through the play time. They didn't dominate the playtime. They didn't tell their kids how to play. They supported them in whatever interactions that they had. And that then led to the compliant act of helping clean up toys. So it's an interesting kind of, we always think it's the opposite. Well, I've got to get him to do exactly what I say to do, and then he will always do exactly what I want him to do. Well, no, it works the other way, that when we go along with what they want, then they're more likely to go along with what we want. And so, anyway, with that, I took up more time than I thought, but I'd love to take some questions about what's of interest to you or perplexing to you. I mean, these little guys, I think, more than anything, especially the toddler, we have two here, it can be very perplexing. It can be, he's out to get me. It's him against me. I've got to win in the situation. And it's, doesn't always have to be that way. Any questions about anything about kids?
I have one here.
Yes.
It's the old classic example that the kid gets the toy and has more fun with the box.
Right.
Or the wrappers or anything.
Yeah.
And what does that say about their awareness of what toys are?
Well, no, it's not about, it's just that what I think it is, or what I know it to be, is that the box and the paper meet them at where their learning lies. That the toy, they probably figured it out, but a new piece of paper and a new box is of high interest to a child because they've never seen that particular piece of paper or that box. And, depending upon the age of the child, American marketing has done a very good job of getting us to think that kids are about something completely different than what they are really about. I mean, if you want to spend an afternoon with a toddler and don't know what to do, I encourage you to go buy a postal tube and fill it with balls and see what happens. I mean, that will be a 45-minute interaction with the child because that's where their learning lies. They're learning about cause and effect and how balls roll, and they're hidden inside the tube and they come out and they roll all different ways and they ricochet off each other. You'll have a great time. If you go out and buy, some kind of a glitzy DVD, from Baby Einstein or Baby Mozart, not only, your child might watch that, but it's erroneous. It doesn't really meet them where their learning is. And also, it's not going to enhance them and make them more intelligent. But yeah, I remember giving my son 1 year for his birthday a box of tape. Red tape and green tape and it was just waste the tape. I mean, he spent more time with tape, doing creative things with tape, than any other toy you could ever buy. So, yeah. Other questions? Yes.
I heard something, I can't remember, it was like on the radio or something about how screen time, like computer or TV time for children under 2 can be detrimental. Is that something you've heard or have
any? Yeah, it's true. I mean, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no screen time for children under age 2. And it's because children need real life, three-dimensional interaction with people. I'll just tell you an interesting piece of research. So this was done at the University of Washington. Pat Kuhl, who's an esteemed language researcher out there, wanted to know, we all know that that the younger we teach children a second language, the better. Okay? So she brought children into the research labs, all native English speakers. She brought children who were between 6 and 12 months into the lab. And in the lab were Mandarin speakers. Okay? And they came once a week, and I can't remember, it was like for 6 months. Okay? And so what they found was that those children who had face-to-face interaction with Mandarin speakers held on to the phonemes of that language. One interaction a week. Okay, and I can't remember if it was 20 minutes or 40 minutes or whatever. Then they had another group of children watch DVDs of Mandarin speakers playing with children. It was exactly the same situation. It was children being read to by Mandarin speakers. They were watched them on the DVD or the CD or whatever it was. And so they watched the playroom where the children had actually been. Those children did not hold on to the phonemes of Mandarin Chinese. So there's something lost in the video experience. I mean, don't we all know this?
Yeah.
I mean, and I, you know, I tell parents that if you need to take a shower, hey, go ahead, stick in the DVD and take care of yourself, do it. I mean, guilt-free, go ahead. But just don't think that that experience is gonna enhance the intellect of your child. You know, no matter how fancy, no matter how glitzy, no matter how whatever. And then, of course, as children get older, we want to limit screen time. And if you do watch, if children do watch it with them, so you have this combined experience, and then you can talk about it. So, okay. Other questions? Yes.
What about temper tantrums?
Okay, let's talk about temper tantrums. Okay, temper tantrums, and I'm going to talk about anger later in the week. I can't remember what day now. I think it's Friday. But so here's the research that they did, researchers. That the children were, I can't remember now, 12 to 18 months anyway. So they would put, they would give a child a toy to play with, okay? And then they would put the toy inside a sealed plastic container. I mean, who wouldn't be mad, right? And so the children would just be, they would be so mad because they couldn't get at it, right? And so, you know, determined that yes, at about, you know, do we all know this, about 18 months, children have temper tantrums. And why? It's because prior to that, prior to age 18 months or 12 months, we indulge children completely, right? If they're hungry, we feed them. If they want to socialize, we socialize with them. If they're tired, we put them to bed. If they want to be rocked, we rock them back and forth. But now, when they get to be about 18 months, and they've eaten two cookies, and we put the cookies away, they're going to be mad, right? We're delaying. We're saying, no, you can't have another cookie till after dinner. And we're delaying gratification of their needs, okay? Can't remember what day it is. I think it's Wednesday. I'm talking about resisting raising children who feel entitled. What I want to tell you is a tease for all of you to come and to tell your friends about it, that when we appropriately delay gratification of children's wants, the long-term outcomes for children is better. Okay? We can't have, but temper tantrums get us, right? Because you really think that child is going to explode if they don't get that cookie right now. I mean, my granddaughter, I mean, it's so interesting. She was, you know, typical granddaughter. You know, the older child didn't want the younger one to have the otter, the stuffed otter. And so they're screaming, yelling, fighting about it. So grandma puts it up on the refrigerator. You know, we're just going to put it up there. So the younger one's screaming, screaming, screaming. I mean, you think she is going to just die from a temper tantrum. And so I said to Amelia, the older one, I said, no, she'll be fine. You know, this is my work. And I didn't tell Amelia that. She's five. And Amelia says, oh, Grandma, you have to give it to her because she's just going to carry on and on and on until you give it to her. So, I mean, at five, she's already enabling this temper tantrum process, right? But children, I mean, what if I stood here and said, I just have to have a new Mercedes-Benz. Who is going to buy it for me? I just have to. I mean, people would just think I'm crazy, right? And we have to figure out how we're going to, if we really, really want a Mercedes-Benz, which I don't, but if I did, I have to figure out how I'm going to get one, right? I have to work and save and plan and all of that. So we have to help children on the road to doing that in their best interest. So the question is, what do you do when they have a temper tantrum? First, basically, I'll go into it more when I talk about anger on Friday, but you just shift yourself into low gear, move toward the child, and provide emotional protection. You're just with them. You don't want to say, oh, sweetheart, we had two cookies, and you know, you'll be okay, and all of that. We don't want to do that. We just want to be near them, and it will pass. It usually passes in about 2 minutes, but some children go on more than that, 5 to 10 minutes, and they'll be okay. Babies not. But by the time they're 18 months, they have enough emotional strength to live out the fact that they're not going to get that third cookie.
Yes. I used to work in an early learning center for toddlers, and sometimes, like, if the tantrum got bad and we had, like, things we had to do,
sure,
I would, like, redirect.
Yeah.
Or, like, try and distract them.
Sure,
else.
Absolutely.
Is that wrong?
No. It's absolutely fine. With children under three, we have to, because they have 3 to 5 a day. I mean, you know, if you're in a child center, I mean, you've had, you know, 25, 30 temper, you know. So distraction works very well, okay? As children get older, once they're over three, I don't encourage parents to, and this is parents, which is different than child care providers, okay? I don't encourage parents to distract them because we all have to live with, figure out how to live with the fact that we're not getting what we want right now and that we'll be okay. And it builds their character, right? And so, but we want them to feel supported. We don't want, go to your bedroom if you're going to have, no, we don't want to do that. But we want to have them stay with us or go with them to the bedroom.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm a kindergarten teacher, and I had this little girl very first day of school that year throw a big giant tantrum because she didn't, something didn't happen. She needed to be first in line or
right.
something. And I just very calmly looked at her and I said, you know, that you can feel bad, that's okay,
yeah.
but that really doesn't work for me.
Right.
And she never did it. She
right.
totally changed and never did that
yeah.
again, and her mother couldn't believe it when
right.
we got at the conference,
yeah.
because the mother obviously gave in all the time.
Right, and it works, it's worked somewhere,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so if it begins
yeah.
to work for you, you're going to keep doing
yeah,
it.
But she
but
never
then kids
tried
learn.
It. She got it.
Well, at home it works.
Yeah,
see, kids at home it works, but with teacher it doesn't. I mean, kids
yeah.
are smart, right? And
yeah.
so they... But so, yeah, I mean,
so interesting.
Temper tantrum, and they happen all the ages, you know, and so it's just, it's easier to manage when they're this age than when they're teenagers, right? So, okay, other questions about infants? Oh,
can I have one of your handouts,
yes.
please?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I have a handout here, and also, all of this, I also write for Baby Zone, which is an online magazine, and much of this information is on babyzone.com. So yeah, I'll pass these out. These are the topics that I'm presenting this week, and then also my books are on there and my my handouts. If any of you want handouts, please email me. My email address is on there, and I'll send you a Word document once I get back to Seattle or whenever you get back home, because I just didn't want to bring all that paper, and it's more Holden-esque, right, if we don't have a lot of paper wasting. So
right.
I just did a one-pager, but you can contact me, and I'd be happy to get any of this
Thank
information
you.
Out.
And
okay, yes.
My granddaughter just turned 2, and her language skill is just exploding.
Right.
And it's clear, too, that when we talk to her, that she understands a lot more than she can say.
Right.
Tell me something about, put that in some
sure.
sort of scientific
well,
context.
Yeah, absolutely.
Context.
I mean, in my book there, it just says that, and it's absolutely true with language development, that children's receptive language, what they understand, is much higher than their expressive language. Actually, we're all the same.
Yeah,
we can all
true.
Read more difficult books than that we can really talk about, right? Or, like all of you have heard this information, and it's probably been fairly interesting to you, but if you go back to tell somebody else, you probably won't be as versed in it as I am, because I've spent years learning all of this. And so it catches up, and I can't remember all the details, but it's in there, and it's just very, very normal. And language skills in young children, there are some children who actually, and it's probably what your granddaughter is going through, they just have this burst of language. And then other children are more deliberate, but they catch up in time, and it kind of depends on their personality. And it's, I mean, for me, watching children's language emerge is probably, you can see their mind at work. It's one of the most fascinating periods of development, and yeah, who can resist talking with them? And,